leaders who reimagine systems and build new ones. From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, today is Thursday, May 13th, and this is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we meet three 2021 Bush Fellows from South Dakota. Two of them, I should say. We'll talk language revitalization, improving outcomes for Native students, and the intriguing nuances of equitable community design. We also hear Voices from a Crisis. Our Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Spotlight finds us listening deeply to stories of loss and recovery, trauma, and justice on hold. We invite you to give these stories a place in your life as well this hour. Today, we also plan spaces for gardening and growing with Eric Helland for South Dakota Garden. Send us your questions via email inthemoment@sdpb.org.
With SDPB News, I'm Megan Feary. According to an announcement by the South Dakota Department of Health, 50% of eligible adults in South Dakota are now fully vaccinated against COVID-19. More than 304,000 South Dakotans have finished the full vaccine series. Secretary of Health Kim Malsom-Risden calls it a milestone and says it's one step closer to getting back to normal life.
I'd like to thank all of those who have chosen to become vaccinated, as we do know it's the quickest way for us to end this pandemic. Seeing great progress, but need to continue to get the word out about vaccines and how important they are.
The Department of Health's goal is to vaccinate at least 70% of South Dakotans. Malsom-Risden says battling vaccine hesitancy is difficult.
We continue to see misinformation floating around, but you know, we really, again, want to reinforce that people need to continue to use trusted sources of information about vaccines, about their safety, about their development, and about their impact on human health.
State epidemiologist Joshua Clayton says fully vaccinated is defined as 14 days after the second COVID shot.
So after you have achieved that milestone, you may comfortably visit indoors with other fully vaccinated persons, visit with unvaccinated people, including children, from a single household, unless those individuals are at higher risk. You know, safe to be outside with family, friends, and so on, whether that's attending a barbecue, being in an outdoor setting such as restaurants, the need for physical distancing and masking.
Clayton adds being fully vaccinated does not mean a person is immune to COVID-19. He recommends getting tested immediately if symptoms develop and after traveling. The Department of Health offers free at-home testing kits to all residents. The Food and Drug Administration and the Center for Disease Control and Prevention have authorized use of the Pfizer vaccine for people age 12 to 15. Secretary of Health Kim Malsom-Risden says it's an important step towards reaching herd immunity.
We've had questions before about, you know, is it really important for younger people to become vaccinated, because we know older people tend to be more severely impacted. And the fact of the matter is that it's important for all people who are eligible for vaccines to become vaccinated, because that helps slow the spread of the virus in our communities, and that slows down its ability to develop variants, and it slows down its ability to impact those vulnerable people who could still have a breakthrough case if they have been vaccinated or who have not been vaccinated themselves.
Malsom-Risden says vaccines are the best way to protect against the coronavirus. She says anyone with questions or concerns should consult the Department of Health's website or consult their primary care physician. 50% of eligible adults in the state have finished the full vaccine series, and over 336,000 have received at least one dose. South Dakota Attorney General Jason Roundsburg's trial on charges he's facing in a fatal 2020 crash could begin as early as August. At a status hearing Wednesday, Judge John Brow says he's aiming for the trial to begin in August or early September. Roundsburg's attorney requested 60 more days, citing the need to review key pieces of evidence, including interviews. But the deputy state's attorney for Hyde County is urging the court to move ahead with the trial. That's according to KSFY-TV. Roundsburg is facing several misdemeanor charges in the September crash that killed Joseph Beaver, who was walking along a highway near Highmore when he was struck and killed. With SDPB News, I'm Megan Feary.
And I'm Lori Walsh. Well, the buses roll out Friday at noon. The SDSU football team is headed to Frisco, Texas for a national championship game. Matt Zimmer covers Jackrabbit Athletics for Argus Leader Media. He joins us now with an update. Hey, Matt, welcome back.
Hey, Lori, thanks for having me.
It's time to go. Finally, they made it this far. It's time to celebrate even more.
It's really happening. I'm leaving for Frisco tomorrow morning.
I try not to get too excited until they're on the bus.
Right. I think that's kind of how every Jackrabbit fan has felt throughout this entire spring, yeah.
All right, tell us about this last game because they were, you know, fighting against an undefeated team and they handled it quite well.
Yeah, it's tempting to think, based on how that game went and the fact that their opponent, Sam Houston State, has had to kind of scratch and claw to get here, that maybe mm-hmm. that works in SDSU's favor. But I don't know. I mean, for a long time now, the general consensus at this level of football has been that the two best programs are North Dakota State and James Madison, and those are the two teams that Sam Houston State just beat in back-to-back weeks to get here. Mm-hmm. So that's a pretty big deal. And last week in particular, they were losing 24-3 at halftime, and they came back and won against James Madison. So that's impressive. This is a team that obviously is pretty resilient to kind of withstand what they have the last couple weeks and like mm-hmm. I said, sort of scratch and claw to get here. Having said that, you know, we all expected South Dakota State to have their hands full with Delaware last week, and they completely outclassed them. I mean, they physically dominated them. It was not, you know, a game of a bunch of flukes or trick plays or bad breaks. They were just the far superior team, and it was a little jarring almost to hear Delaware's coach be as conciliatory as he was. He was just like, wow, we thought we were as good as these guys, and we were not. They were really good. So if you're a Jacks fan, that gives you plenty of reason to feel good about this. Having said that, I think it looks pretty clear that these are the two best teams. And like I said, Sam Houston State has played as difficult a schedule as anyone. So I don't think there's any reason to look at this game from either side of it and say, oh, yeah, I'm pretty sure this team is going to win. I truly think it's going to be a close competitive game, and it could go either way.
Yeah, and they're headed to Sam Houston's backyard, pretty much.
Kind of, and I'm very interested to see if that is at all sort of the environment, because, yeah, Sam Houston State is in Texas, and it's right in Texas, but, you know, there's 20 Division I football teams in Texas. And, Sam Houston State, I think, gets lost in the shuffle down there between – you know, UT and Texas Tech and Texas A&M and Houston and on and on and on. They believe they've capped attendance at the game for COVID reasons at like 7,500. Stadium normally holds 20,000. We'll see if they adjust that or depending on ticket sales or whatever. But the day after the game, they gave South Dakota State 3,500 tickets. That was sort of their allotment. And I didn't think they'd sell that out the whole week, because that's about how many people they get at a typical game in Brookings. But they sold it out immediately. And then they opened up some more tickets for Jacks fans, and those sold out immediately. So there's a good chance that the Jacks are going to have something close to, I don't want to say necessarily a home environment down there, but at the very least a neutral one. It sounds like it's going to be a party, and I'm excited to get down there and you know, obviously see the game and be a part of that, but also just kind of see what the few days leading up to the game and the atmosphere on Sunday are like.
Yeah. All right. We got to get everybody healthy too for those COVID protocols. You profiled the coach at argusleader.com. People can find that story. Tell me a little bit about this coach and what it means to head to the national championship with this team.
Well, I mean, he's been there forever. This is his 24th year as the head coach, and he was an assistant coach there for about several years before that. And he goes back to the Division II days when they were in the North Central Conference playing against teams like, sure, South Dakota and North Dakota State, but also, you know, Morningside, Augustana, St. Cloud State, Mankato State. It was a different world back then. And SDSU wasn't necessarily better than any of those programs I just mentioned. They were a very middle-of-the-road Division II team, and when the school decided they wanted to go Division I, it was a very controversial thing. No one knew how it was going to go. A lot of people assumed John Stiglmeyer would lose his job, or at least that they would decide they wanted someone else to lead them through that transition. He was able to do it successfully, and it, you know, to his credit, it didn't take them long to become good. They started winning games pretty quickly and getting into the playoffs, but being a playoff team and being a national championship team are two different things entirely. And it's just within the last 5 years or so that they've kind of taken the next step up to that level. And it's a big deal for John because, you know, he's a South Dakota State alum. He's from Selby. This is personal to him. And there were a lot of people, I think, that doubted that he could get them there. So, you know, everyone, I think, who's associated with the university, who knows John, was very happy for him to finally get to make this trip because it was definitely a long, long, long time coming.
Yeah. All right. Well, the buses roll out at noon on Friday as the SDSU football team, the Jacks, are headed to Frisco, Texas. That game Sunday kickoff is at 1 p.m. Central at Toyota Stadium in Frisco, and it airs on ABC. You can follow Matt Zimmer's coverage at ArgusLeader.com and on Twitter. Thanks, Matt.
Thanks, Lori.
I'm Jackie Hendry, host of South Dakota Focus. SDPB has spent the past month shining a spotlight on our relationship with guns in our state. On the next South Dakota Focus, we continue the conversation with legal experts, sports enthusiasts, and people who've experienced gun violence. We'll also learn more about South Dakota youth hunting adventures with our next Good Neighbor. That's Thursday night at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on SDPB-TV.
Program funding is provided by First Dakota National Bank. First Dakota National Bank celebrates individuals and businesses with a passion to turn their dreams into South Dakota firsts. Learn more at firstdakota.com/first.
Stevie Wonder is one of the most popular artists in American music, with a string of big hits from the 1960s through the 80s. His songs also have a melodic and harmonic sophistication that make them favorites in the jazz world. Herbie Hancock said, "Wonder is the one pop star that pretty much every jazz musician has to take seriously." Today is Wonder's 71st birthday, and this evening on Jazz Nightly, we'll celebrate with some interpretations of his music. I'm Carl Gerke, and you can join me at 8 Central, 7 Mountain.
Program funding is provided by the South Dakota Cultural Heritage Center in Pierre. The museum now offers free admission to South Dakota residents and children from everywhere. Coronavirus protections in place. More at 773-3458 or history.sd.gov.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. The SDPB Spotlight explores topics that impact our lives here at home. We get beyond the national rhetoric over complex issues and take a deep look at how these issues are interwoven into our lives. We do that through research, reporting, and deep listening as we ask for your stories. You can find those projects on our website at sdpb.org/spotlight. Tonight's South Dakota Focus on SDPB-TV asks thoughtful questions about our relationship with guns in this state. And host Jackie Hendry joins us now from the SDPB studios in Vermilion for a preview. Welcome back, Jackie. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Lori. Thanks for having me.
So you're going to start this show with that policy overview level because it all begins with the Second Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, yes?
Yep. I want to make sure we're all approaching this with kind of a similar foundation of knowledge. Our first guest tonight, dedicated SDPB listeners, will recognize the name Chuck Parkinson. He's a longtime congressional staffer, a political mind in South Dakota. And as you know, Lori, he loves talking about this stuff. He's going to join us to really talk about kind of that origin of the Second Amendment, why that was so important to include in the Constitution of the United States. And we're also going to talk a little bit about some of the key Supreme Court cases over the years that have really come to shape our broader and current kind of understanding of this idea of firearms and bearing arms in the United States.
Yeah, including whether or not people have that individual right outside of their own homes, which is such a fascinating conversation. And then, meanwhile, we have these conversations happening here in South Dakota and here in the State House, and you're going to take a look at that recent work as well. Tell me more about that.
Exactly. We're going to be welcoming Representative Kevin Jensen when he's not in session in Pierre. He's a certified enhanced concealed carry instructor here in South Dakota. He runs a business on firearms instruction. And he also wrote this year House Bill 1212, which is meant to clarify in state law, basically use of lethal force in self-defense situations. And that bill passed all the way through. Governor Noem signed it into law, so that takes effect this summer. So Representative Jensen will be joining us to talk about why he saw a need for this bill and how it's going to change his job and realities for folks who do carry concealed firearms in South Dakota for self-defense purposes and what they should know.
And that's so interesting because lawmakers really grappled with that. It wasn't an easy decision because of how this bill is written. So I look forward to tuning in into that. Mm-hmm. Jackie, for most of us here in the state, guns are about recreation in some way. It's hunting. It's target shooting. It's things like that. Are you going to cover any of that story as well?
You bet. Nate Weck has brought us a really fun feature. Yankton High School is one of 49 high schools in the state with a club trap shooting team, but one of just 8 in the state with a competitive skeet shooting team. So for the uninitiated, like me, trap shooting, that's when the targets are shot away from you at a fairly predictable height. Skeet shooting, they kind of cross in front of you at different heights. And so we get to hear from some of those Yankton High School students who have really found a love for the sport.
Nice. All right. You've got a good neighbor, too, as well.
Yes.
This is one of my favorite new features that South Dakota Focus has brought to the table with you, Jackie, as host, and it's the good neighbor time.
Yes. This week, we're honoring Brian Mueller. He's his day job. He's chief deputy with the Pennington County Sheriff's Office. But we're excited to highlight him based on his volunteer work with an organization called South Dakota Youth Hunting Adventures. They're kind of related to your Big Brother, Big Sister programs. And Brian mentors local young people by teaching them about gun safety, taking them hunting, learning about conservation. So as part of this segment, I asked him why those activities are such good avenues for mentoring young people. And here's what he had to say.
You know, our motto is more than a hunt, it's an adventure. And it's truly much bigger than hunting and conservation. It's building a good, positive mentor relationship with these young people. And we've really seen it change the trajectory for people that were headed down the wrong road in life and having struggles maybe with personal life or school. And we really focus with our mentors on making sure people are getting good grades, they're attending school, and then using this as a rewards program. And we've had really good success with that, too.
Mm. We're talking right now with Jackie Hendry, host of South Dakota Focus, which airs tonight. You can tune in for that live program on SDPB-TV. And, of course, Jackie, when you talk about guns, there is always a painful side to that. A little bit in this hour, we're going to hear from someone that you'll feature on Focus 2, Sage Trudell, telling the story of what happened after her brother got shot and the impact of gun violence on the people left behind. But you also talked with Dr. Matt Stanley with Avera. Tell me a little bit about what Dr. Stanley brings to the conversation when it comes to our relationship with guns and how they impact our lives in the state.
Well, this is some of the jaw-dropping statistics that Dr. Stanley shared with me. He's the the clinical vice president for the Behavioral Health Service Line with Avera, and he's a psychiatrist. He talks a bit about the role of PTSD for people who are left behind after a traumatic thing like gun violence, but also the role of firearms and suicides in South Dakota and the nation. 50% of suicides occur with the use of a firearm, but another statistic he shared with me is that a suicide attempt with a firearm will result in a death more than 90% of the time, whereas every other method results in death just 4% of the time. So Dr. Stanley says the presence of firearms when a person is in that crisis is a really big factor.
The other thing we know about these attempted suicides is most don't go on to end their life by suicide. So you have a 4% chance against a 90% chance. If you can just remove that firearm, remove that opportunity to make an irredeemable choice 90% of the time, we think you've significantly improved your opportunity to survive whatever you're going through.
And I should say that removal of firearms isn't by government means or anything like that. It's more the idea of maybe storing the guns outside of the home for a little while, or adding additional locks, or just adding additional barriers to the firearms in your home if you or someone you love is in a crisis, just to add just that little bit between you and that impulse if you're facing a mental health crisis.
Yeah. And Jackie, I think it goes, you know, this is Mental Health Awareness Month. So it's worth noting that, you know, getting rid of that stigma of talking about suicide and mental illness goes a long way in being able to have some of those other conversations. I know I had a friend on Facebook who posted something about not wanting to lose his gun, and a bunch of his friends came online and just said, you shouldn't have one right now. I'll keep it for you. And people showed up at his house and sort of helped him through that moment because he was willing to talk about it, and they were willing to talk about it too. So
exactly.
More on that later. And of course, tonight's South Dakota Focus, you can tune into that on SDPB TV at 8 Central, 7 Mountain. Find all our Spotlight coverage, by the way, at sdpb.org/spotlight. As we do the programs, we put them up on that website. And we want you to participate in these Spotlight stories as well. In May, we're inviting you to share your stories about missing and murdered Indigenous women. You can call our number, 605-951-0740, and tell us a story. Tell us the name of your stolen sister. You might hear that on In the Moment. You can also always send us an email at inthemoment@sdpb.org. Jackie Hendry in Vermilion, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lori.
Ahead on the program, we are going to meet some of the 2021 Bush Fellows from South Dakota. You are on Listener Supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
In the fight to convince skeptics to get a COVID vaccine, misinformation can be dangerous. Most of the rumors and lies on social media are not new. They were already being spread about other vaccines.
You know, it's almost like conspiracy theory Mad Libs. They just inserted the new claims.
Why these claims persist this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Listen, beginning at 3 Central, 2 Mountain, on SDPB.
Program funding is provided by Denny Menholt Auto Group, Rapid City. During this time, we are here and ready to serve you. We will pick up and deliver your car for services. From everyone here at Denny Menholt Auto, we wish you and your family the very best.
The businesses you hear on SDPB support us for a variety of reasons. The key reason is that they recognize that this audience is unique. When your organization is mentioned as a supporter of SDPB, you're telling our loyal, engaged listeners that you care about the things they care about. Our audience pays attention and is more likely to do business with an organization that supports SDPB. We invite your organization to become an underwriter. Email underwrite@sdpb.org and we'll talk.
Program funding with your support and by McCrory Gardens in Brookings, planting over 40,000 flowers every spring. More information at McCroryGardens.com. McCrory Gardens, ready to bloom.
You're listening to In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Lori Walsh. The Bush Foundation invests in great ideas and the people who found them. They search for leaders who can imagine new systems and transform existing ones. And they have found four such leaders to honor as 2021 Bush Fellows from South Dakota. We're going to meet two of them today. From rethinking equitable community design to radically improving educational outcomes for Lakota students, this year's fellows have expansive plans for impacting communities here at home. And today, we get to know Patry Acevedo Fuentes and Camamila Locke. Camamila, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Patry, thank you as well.
Hey, thanks.
All right, Patry is joining us from Rapid City, and Camamila is joining us from Standing Rock and Fort Yates, North Dakota. And I want to, let's ground people in first, congratulations, and what kind of a process was this to go to become a Bush Fellow, and how did you sort of feel when you got that phone call? Come, Amelia, let's start with you. Tell us about the process and getting that phone call.
Sure. So we started last summer. I think, I can't remember if it was June or July, just kind of discussing, or it was a friend of mine, Teresa, was put it in my head and was asking. I was like, oh, no. And then, I kind of looked at the process and thought, no. But luckily, he continued to push. I really, really appreciate that. But it was two writing processes and also two interview processes from, I can't remember if it was August or September when the first part was submitted.
There
was different various levels that we had to move up. And as I got the notification for each one, it was kind of, I'm actually shaking just thinking about it. It's really amazing to, you know, when you look at the people who have applied, the people who have applied in the past, it feels like a huge accomplishment, a huge recognition. I'm very grateful in receiving this.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't want to scare anybody off from applying for this, because there are lots of, you know, ways the Bush Foundation helps you walk through this application process. Mm-hmm. But the goal is to help you really think about why you're doing this and what you want to do with it. And a lot of effort goes into just the application and acceptance process. Patrie, what did you find from that process that helped you kind of fine tune what you wanted to do with this fellowship?
I'm going to just say that my first thing was similar to Camomilla. It's not me. Like, this is, I'm not, I couldn't see myself in this, right? But then it was, with everything that was happening last year, it was a big question of, if it's not me, then who, right? And so I sort of raised my hand and I started going down the path of this process. And it was a really beautiful journey of a lot of evolution from a very abstract idea of what was in my head and what I felt needed somebody to step up for, to a very, like, there was a lot of focus and a lot of clarity. And similar to Camomilla, every time I got the notice, it was like a disbelief. It was like, oh, are they sure? Like, are we sure we're doing this? And it's still like not completely sinking in, other than the level of like, oh no, I have to do it now, right?
right.
Like, I was so convincing that here we go.
And you do this work on behalf, I mean, this is on behalf of a community, and that adds a certain sense of responsibility, and as well as, I mean, they will help you with leadership and they will help you with travel, but at the end of the day, it helps so many more people than just the people we're talking to today. Patrie, I want to know a little bit about equitable community design, and what area are you sort of working with this fellowship?
So, one of the amazing things about this Bush Foundation is that it's very flexible, right? You get to define what your community really is. So the way I see community, it's not only my physical community of Rapid City where I reside, but I also work across the states in different sites. Either it's in Eagle Butte or Red Cloud. Like, it could be in like a lot of different places, along with Pier. So I define community, but I'm also looking at it from the terms of the practice of the architectural community. So when I'm talking about building more equitable communities, it has to do a lot with the process of architecture, how we are employing that process, and who we design for. A lot of times when we're designing for a client, we design specifically for that client. But if that client is serving a population, we need to be concentrating on that population. It goes back to that saying that if you're not at the table, you're probably on the menu. And then there's this like flip that I read recently, which is like, if you don't have a seat at the table, just bring a folding chair. So my goal is to start expanding who is at the table and whose voice we get to hear when we are designing. Architecture school teaches you that you are that vision and that you have this great idea and you implement it. But the truth is that we are not the know-all, end-all of what our communities should be. And we need to have a more permeable process that really allows different voices to be at the table, because what I do is concrete, right? The building where mm-hmm. the JLG Architects office is, which is who I work with, is it was built in 1911. So it's permanent and it is concrete. So for us to make sure that we're really bringing the important people to the table, the community who will be served through our projects, is just absolutely important.
Yeah. Camomila, speaking of important people, you have this goal of radically improving educational outcomes for Lakota youth. And I love that the word there is radical, because there is much work to be done in this area. Tell me a little bit about your fellowship and what your intentions are for it.
So this is actually in support of work that I was already participating in and helping in. And it's, I get really excited thinking about this, because this, the Miniwichoni Nakichize Wolunspe, was started during the prayer camps and resistance to the Dakota Access Pipeline. And it was essentially the school that, you know, for the young people that were there. And during that time, we got to experience education in motion, in community, in learning with the knowledge keepers, in learning with the geniuses that was there, in learning with the allies that came, in learning with not only our local geniuses, as well as the indigenous leaders who came. So that's really where we've decided to ground it. And I have, you know, I've been in education since 2001, I guess 20 years. Crazy to think that, but in coming home and seeing, coming home, I lived away for 24 years and kind of bounced around the world, lived in a lot of different places, taught in almost every kind of school system, private, independent, suburbia, res, inner city, what have you. I've taught, and I just kind of figured wherever there's students, yeah, I can teach. So that's what I do.
Yeah.
And this is, I came home and have literally been able to pull the best part that I've experienced in all these places. The team that I work with, they're also, radical in the way we're looking at this and really shifting into an indigenous way of being. And that, it's really holistic in looking at the whole person, and really understanding that if we look at the context of us as being just a part of the entire system, that we're inevitably going to study, hit all of the quote-unquote standards. We'll also learn indigenous knowledge, ways of being, as functioning, and ultimately being a good relative. So it's also having that lens of looking 125 years down the way, or looking ahead of how we can set systems up that are beneficial for everyone, as opposed to, you know, just going through and getting the paper and helping yourself. And yeah, I can go on tangents about this. I get really excited about really shifting the way we educate our young ones, the way we, as people on this land, the way we can interact with our young people, and believing that we're smart enough. And that's the mm-hmm. ultimate one, is believing that we're smart enough to educate our young people, because we are.
Yeah.
So radical acts of sovereignty.
Radical acts of sovereignty. If you're just tuning in, we're talking with two of the 2021 Bush Foundation Bush Fellows, and it's Patrie Acevedo Fuentes and Camomila Locke. And Patrie, I'm wondering, I'll just ask the question like this: how does your work intersect with Camomila's? When she's talking about, you know, being in an educational setting where there is essentially no traditional, you know, community building, but yet there is this way of being in this space, in this shared mm-hmm. physical space. I'm just curious, when you listen to her talk, what sparks in your mind about spatial justice movement and the work that you're doing?
So when we talk about spatial justice, like the way I define it, because I live in the nerdy way of calling it, it's like the built environment, right? It's really equitable access to services, and education is a critical service. So when she's like talking about it, I get super excited because we're both, even though I talk about the concrete things, she's talking about abstract, right? And we're both talking about access to it, but also self-determination in terms of like, it's again, to who do we bring to the table, right? So I'm a tool for what Camomila does, right? I build this space that she needs in order to succeed. So that's how I see myself in the game board, like one of the puzzle pieces of what she needs in order to elevate the work that she is doing.
Camomila, same question.
Yes.
When you hear her talk, what sort of things spark in you about your work?
We're really reconstructing quote-unquote systems and making them work for us. It really feels like it's systems of sovereignty that can intersect with one another and obviously are in support of one another. So in much as she was saying, she'd like to create a space for educators. That's literally what we're trying to do for the next generation, is create this, you know, safe space for the next group coming up, and so that they can, you know, step into education in knowing that they can be and do, and that's it, that they can be.
Yeah. And another commonality I can...
I was going to say that Camomila was talking about it in generational terms, right? And when I talk about the concreteness of what we do, like, that's another place where, like, we're saying the same exact thing, right? Like, we are reinventing the way in which, like, the system works.
Exactly. Yeah.
I was just going to say that, too, because you mentioned being in this building that has been around for more than a century. And, you know, she is at this place where she's, you know, sitting at the feet of elders telling stories that have, you know, some of them have been around nearly a century. And what I want to know next is as you do this work today, you have to also feel the possibility and the weight of how long your own work and the work of the people that you bring to that table could impact people in the future. And it could impact them, hopefully, in a vastly different way than some of these other things have. Camomila, tell me a little bit about that. Do you think about the future and generations to come?
Certainly, certainly. And that's the why. That's really the why. Because we, you know, we've arrived at this point. I started in kindergarten in 1980. The last group of kids taken here, I believe, in Center was in 78. So, you know, the boarding school era, the era of young people, you know, being taken from their homes, that's not the distant past. And we've seen where education that we have currently, and not say, no, all education, I'm saying the education that exists currently here at this spot is not serving the population. So, you know, ultimately, it's why not? Like, why not, like, take the time and make, you know, try to create a system that will serve the young people? You know, those of us who have made it, I recognize that. That's my privilege. At different points along the way, I had, you know, that help. And it shouldn't be that way. It shouldn't be just a few of us who have made it through the cracks and, I've made it. It should be, creating change, creating systems where whole generations are able to arrive and be whole people and be healthy. And definitely. The future is the why.
Yeah. All right. Why not? And if not me, who? And we thank you for saying yes to this process and really look forward to having you back on the program and talking more as these fellowships develop. There's lots of mentorship and networking and connectivity that goes on. And these are the leaders who are rethinking those systems and sometimes creating them from scratch. My guests have been Patrie Aceveda Fuentes and Camomila Locke, two of the 2021 Bush Fellows. Patrie, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Camomila, thank you.
Thank you. That was awesome. Thank you.
Excellent time. Lots to think about there. You can learn more about the 2021 Bush Fellows online at bushfoundation.org. That's also where you can find information about applying to become a Bush Fellow and the ways you can imagine your own community and having an influence on it in new ways. Well, let's take a pause after that heady conversation, because this month the SDPB Spotlight brings awareness to the crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women, and you can find our coverage online as we posted at sdpb.org/spotlight. On May 5th, SDPB's Jackie Hendry and Crystal Schoenbauer reported from PEER at an event designed to raise awareness for missing and murdered Indigenous women. And today we're going to hear from Sharon Brings-Plenty. She spoke in front of the state capitol at that event. Her daughter, Tessa LeVay Curley, was stabbed to death in her apartment in Box Elder in October. A note for listeners, this can be hard to listen to, but here is Sharon Brings-Plenty in her own words.
I don't know how to get through the day, but I pray and pray a lot. I pray for answers. Pray for justice for my daughter, Tessa. She didn't deserve to die like that. Not for her mother to find her. Something that I will never, ever forget, never get out of my mind. Somebody comes and asks me, do you need anything? What do you need? I just need your prayers. I just need your prayers. Prayers for strength to get me through this. Till we find out who did this to my daughter and why. Why did they do that? She didn't deserve to die that way. Not like that. Not the way I found her. No. No mother should go through that. She had a lot going. She was talking about going, she danced as a fancy dancer as a little girl. And I lost another daughter back in May of 2019. So after that 1 year, she talked about going back into the dance arena as a traditional dancer. And she bought the material, and we were gonna start making her regalia. The first place she wanted to dance was up in Stanford, Palo Alto, California. We had all these plans. Now those plans will never happen.
That is Sharon Brings-Plenty, recorded live on May 5th when she spoke in front of the state capitol as part of an event to raise awareness for missing and murdered Indigenous women. Her daughter's name is Tessa LeVay Curley. Now, according to the Sovereign Bodies Institute, South Dakota has more than 170 missing and murdered Indigenous women. The average age of those women and girls is 24. One in three are 21 years or younger. 77 of the cases in South Dakota are unsolved. We want you to participate in these spotlight stories. In May, we're inviting you to share your stories about missing and murdered Indigenous women. You can call 605-951-0740. Tell us your story. Tell us the name of your stolen sister. You may hear it on In the Moment. You can also email us at inthemoment@sdpb.org. Ahead on the program, we'll have more stories from the Capitol building on May 5th. But first, we dive into gardening and growing and planning some spaces for your summer gardens. Eric Helland is ahead on listener-supported South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. A digital news startup is buying up dozens of small local newspapers in Colorado to save them from hedge fund investors.
These are the only folks out there who are covering, in many cases, city councils, county commissions, school boards, and it's just absolutely vital to preserve those voices.
Is it the future for local news? That's next time on Here and Now.
This afternoon, beginning at 1 Central, noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by Sanford Underground Research Facility, supporting South Dakota teachers and students with classroom resources, field trips, and professional development. Learn more at sanfordlab.org.
I'm Jackie Hendry, host of South Dakota Focus. SDPB has spent the past month shining a spotlight on our relationship with guns in our state. On the next South Dakota Focus, we continue the conversation with legal experts, sports enthusiasts, and people who've experienced gun violence. We'll also learn more about South Dakota youth hunting adventures with our next Good Neighbor. That's Thursday night at 8 Central, 7 Mountain on SDPB-TV.
Program funding is provided by the South Dakota Humanities Council, celebrating literature, promoting civil conversation, and telling the stories that define our state. Learn more at sdhumanities.org.
Everyone needs a little space to grow, and today we're going to talk about planning your garden space with Eric Helland. He's with Landscape Garden Center, and it is time for our South Dakota Home Garden Conversation. Hey, Eric, how are you?
Good. How are you, Lori?
I am doing well, and it's time to make some plans and turn some earth. You've got three different ways to sort of choose how you plant a garden. Tell us what those are.
Yeah, so the three different ways that we always say is, you know, looking for a place to grow vegetables or even just grow flowers is, one, you want to find a space that is going to be in full sun. So a regular traditional garden where you're going to go into the ground, the actual ground itself, remove grass or find a place that grass hasn't been growing. Those are a couple of highlights you're going to want to be careful of, because you want to find a place where grass has been growing, because that would be in full sun. And that is going to be at ground level. Very traditional. That's how my grandparents used to garden. And then you go on to a raised garden. A raised garden basically is, it can be built out of anything. I've seen them built out of tires, which works well. Timbers. We do a lot of those types of raised garden beds.
All right, let's talk a little bit about things like crop rotation and moving things about, because you can't just stay in the same old gardening rut.
So with plants all take things from the ground and they also put things back. So when you have a plant that has been, like farmers do this all the time, they crop rotate or rotate their crops. So you typically will not ever grow corn over and over, because corn will take a lot of nitrogen out of the soil, whereas beans will help put it back in. So that's what we always say is the things, you can research this and look into the plant families. All plants are within their own family. And if you look at those families, you do not want to be planting in the same exact spot within the same family. You want to change those families around. So that's just kind of a good rule of thumb to do. Very simple to do, and it's also important to do that, because what you'll do is you'll maintain the structure of the soil, and the structure meaning the complexity that helps it grow and have everything, the mycorrhizae, the nutrients and all of that stuff. So then that way you have a really balanced garden, and then you don't have one year that's like, well, why didn't my garden grow? It was deficient in something.
Right. So that soil health is everything. All right. Tell us a little bit about some fun ideas. Mini restaurant gardening. I like that one very much.
Mini restaurant gardening. So, yeah, we were talking about this the other day. It's one of those things is that it's like, okay, well, have some fun with this. Gardening doesn't have to be serious. So look for something that you can make salsa out of. You know, you need tomatoes, peppers, and some onions. Put them all into one container and set that off to the side, because you know, the requirements are going to be pretty much almost the same. And then you can have a pizza container, you know. And that was like basically the third way of growing something. We went through the flat garden, raised garden, and then container garden. So this makes the third one it's just a lot of fun, especially kids. Kids can get a kick out of it. They might not have tremendous amount of produce, but it gets their mind thinking. It gets them active and their fingers dirty.
All right. So all kinds of things in this content that I'm going to let people know where they can find more. But Eric Helen, he joins us in the moment on Thursdays for South Dakota Home Garden. Nice to talk to you again, Eric. See you soon.
Thanks, Lori.
All right. There are a few ways that you can be a part of the SDPB gardening and growing community. You can tune in on Thursdays to hear Eric here, and you can ask him your questions by sending us an email at inthemoment@sdpb.org. Anytime, we'll get your question in queue for one of the next episodes with him. You can also join other South Dakota gardeners on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Just use the hashtag SDHomeGarden. New segments of the digital series, we post them every week at sdpb.org/sdhomegarden. And they're also on SDPB TV all the way through September 12th. They're on Thursdays, Saturdays, and again on Sundays throughout the day. That is South Dakota Home Garden with Eric Helland. Now, let's talk some more about SDPB's May Spotlight on Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women. On May 5th, people gathered outside the Capitol building and pier to raise awareness, to remember lost relatives, and to call for action in returning missing relatives or seeking justice for unsolved or unpunished crimes. One of the speakers that day was Sage Trudell. Sage's brother Quentin was shot and killed in 2005 when he was 17 years old. Quentin's death marked the beginning of a downward spiral for Sage, which many people who have lost loved ones or have had them go missing can relate to. So here is Sage talking about how her brother's murder upended her life and how she eventually found that life again.
That's the day my heart broke. I didn't understand the loss or even the trauma that would follow that. I couldn't watch TV shows that had guns. I still struggle with being around them. They really remind me of just that day. I had never lost anybody close to me. So Quentin's murder literally changed everything about my life. Within 6 months of the shooting, I had lost custody of my children. I had dropped out of college. I lost my home, my vehicle. I attempted suicide. And I turned to alcohol. I was drunk almost every single day for several years. I started going in and out of jail. I had a really hard time because I didn't understand, like I didn't get it. And this was in 2005 where the awareness and the ability to be helpful to the people, it just wasn't there because it just wasn't there. And at that time, all I knew that I was angry. I was angry at the system. I was angry at Quentin because he left me. I was angry at Creator. I didn't understand why Tunkhanshala had come and take in such a part of me. I raised Quentin a lot. My mom went to school and she was a single mother and she struggled as well. So as the only girl, a lot of that responsibility fell on me. So when Quentin died, it felt like I lost one of my children, not just my brother, but the baby of our family. I ended up going to prison. In prison, I actually had to go there twice. but prison brought me back to the people. It brought me back to the women. And I had to make a decision. There was multiple factors happening then. My dad was dying of cancer. My mom was struggling with all of my children. I had used Quentin as an excuse to destroy my life, to let everything go, to not be responsible. So I started to feel shame, even some embarrassment as my mind got clear and a little more coherent and it wasn't so foggy anymore. I realized how I had felt that I had been disrespecting him by using him as an excuse to not take care of myself or any of my responsibilities versus using him as a reason to really be grateful that I still had my life. that I had the ability to move forward. I think a lot when we focus on our missing and murdered relatives, we forget about the survivors. And there literally is trauma and the struggle to heal. Quentin, this year will be 16 years. And sometimes I can't remember what his voice sounds like. And it's those little tiny things where I could hear him in my head, but I can't quite hear him. But then he started to come to me. He started to come to me in the beginning. He actually came for me the day after we buried him. We buried him November 12th of 2005. And I had a dream, and in that dream, something was hurting me, something I couldn't see. And I have two other brothers on my mom's side, and they both left. And I was crying in my dream and asking them to stay with me. And all of a sudden, Quentin was standing there, and he looked beautiful. He had on the hat we buried him in, and a white t-shirt, like a leather type jacket and jeans, and these like really cool boots, you know, because he really liked his style. But he was just smiling at me, and he just put his hand out to me. And I feel that he gave me an option. And I remember I went to take his hand in my dream, and then I pulled it back and I said, I can't, I'm scared. I can't go with you. And in our way, if I had gone with him, I wouldn't be here today. But I also feel like he gave me an option because he let me know that if I stayed, it was going to be hard. And there was going to be things that were hurting me that I couldn't quite identify, but that was, my heart broke, and it never broke the same. It's never hurt that way. And he helped me. He's guided me a lot. I would have dreams about him telling me to be sober, to straighten up, to go back to the ways. And I got out of prison in I flatted out my number in January of 2014. I had gone through treatment, I did parenting classes, they did all these things that I had just didn't want to, because I needed my life back. And my kids needed me, like, I needed to live, because something in me died when he left.
That is Sage Trudell, recorded on May 5th at a gathering in Pierre to remember and to grieve missing and murdered Indigenous women and relatives. Sam Reed pled guilty to fatally shooting Sage's brother Quentin in 2005. You can find more on our May Spotlight series on our website, sdpb.org/spotlight. That's also where you will find full remarks from this event. That was just an excerpt there. Now, according to the South Dakota Missing Persons Clearinghouse, there are currently 96 missing people in the state. 64 of them are Native American.